Get started.
Committee on Finance and Revenue will come to order. Good morning, everyone. We are going to start off with a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2485. This was a bill that the House has already passed. Department of Revenue requested technical housekeeping bill that we have an amendment for that adds on to the central assessment changes that we've been making this year. So, Kyle, if you want to give us the update on the amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2485, we do have a dash 3 amendment. It is up there in OLIS, and we do have the paperwork as well, the revenue impact and the fiscal. What the dash 3 would do, it makes two changes to enrolled Senate Bill 611. So the first change is it modifies, and this is on page 1, lines 14 and 15, it makes a modification of the capacity language. So the existing language, as the bill passed, was a capacity of at least 1 gigabit, and the change would make it the capacity to provide at least approximately 1 gigabit. And some of the concern there was that under the existing language it said 1 gigabit, but there could be fluctuations at some times during due to high demand. So it was tweaked a little bit there. And then the second change is on page 3, the dash 3 amendments, lines 19 and 20. And it just changes, the change there is to remove the lesser of 20 consecutive property tax years. So the exemption under the dash 3 would be granted for the period during which the owner maintains and operates the qualified project. So it removes that 20-year lesser of. And those are the two changes in Senate Bill 611.
Thank you. And this was the tier in the in that bill that tried to get at the incentive for high-speed internet. And Google has been very interested in pursuing that, and Phil Donovan is representing Google here, although this is open, of course, to everyone, and we've heard and seen interest from other corporations as well. But Phil, you weigh in on this dash 3 amendment to the bill. If you'd like, you could speak to the underlying bill as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair House, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan, and my firm represents Google here in Oregon. First off, thank you for your continued efforts to modernize Oregon's central assessment statutes. Over a year ago, Google Fiber announced its interest in building out fiber to the home in 34 cities across the country, including 6 communities here in Oregon. Our hope and desire then and today is to build in every one of those communities. In January, we announced build-out plans in Raleigh-Durham, Atlanta, Nashville, Charlotte. Last Tuesday, we announced our build-out plans in Salt Lake City. We're not quite there in some of those other remaining cities, but like here in Oregon, we remain committed to continue our efforts to increase access to high-speed internet. We applaud the desire of the legislature, the Oregon legislature, to create a fair and competitive landscape for companies that are looking to invest infrastructure and enable high-speed internet. Passage of Senate Bill 611 and the two changes found in the Dash 3 amendment will address property tax barriers here in Oregon at the state level. For companies who are contemplating high-speed internet infrastructure investments. So while work remains to be done with our local partners, Gresham, Tigard, Beaverton, we're continuing these conversations. We're here to see what it will take to make fiber to the home in Oregon possible. So with that, thank you for your work on this legislation and these amendments.
Thank you. And notwithstanding that work with those local cities, the state tax issue is no longer a barrier for Google.
This will address the property tax barriers. Yes.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, I think, more for Kyle. It's a trick question, too, Kyle, so you're not going to like it.
And maybe Mr. Donovan can jump in, not on behalf of Google, but with his expertise in IT, since the state lacks experience in IT. The changes that we're talking about, the capacity to provide at least approximately, what we're really addressing here, if I understand in layman terms, since I'm not an IT guy and I'm certainly not a tax guy, what we're addressing here is the case is if you have a system that's out there that, you know, on a good day averages 1 bit versus 1 byte, 1 bit, right? What we're really talking about here is the trying to resolve the problem if, you know, on an average day, 25,000 customers are using this. On some surprising day, like, I don't know, the Trailblazers playoff or whatever, 50 or 60 or 70,000 people get in, and what happens is you fall above the bit down into whatever that lower category is. Megas, gigas, what is it over there?
Well, down from gigabits to megabits.
To megabits, there we go, okay. That's what we're addressing here. Is that not correct? That's why we have this verbiage?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Boquist, I think that was part of the concern, if you use the example of the NFL is talking about allowing streaming, so if you started streaming the Super Bowl, there might be a lot of demand all at one time, which would bring down that gigabit to maybe 0.7 gigabit or something along those lines. So that was the issue behind the language, I think, is making that more clear that would be allowable for the project to still keep their exemption.
Right. I'm just clarifying that, you know, the target goal and the norm is this, and it's when all of us jump on the internet for whatever sports event or whatever happens to happen, presidential debates, I guess, right? Yeah, right. It drops down, and that's what we're trying to address.
I'll be happy with 0.7.
Yeah, Finance and Revenue Committee, those five minority white guys, right?
And yes, Senator Boquist, the Blazers will be in the playoffs. Okay. Other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair Haas.
All right, we're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move.
No one else has signed up to testify on this bill or the amendment.
Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendment into House Bill 2485.
Senator Boquist moves the -3s on House Bill 2485. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. Senator Boquist?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2485 as amended by the -3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2485 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2485 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. It is up to me. I will carry this bill when it comes through. We'll close the work session and public hearing on 2485. Thank you. Thank you, Kyle. And I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 903. I want to do a refresher with Day on this bill that we held hearings on about 2 weeks ago.
Yes, sir. Chair has members of the committee. Senate Bill 903 repeals the sunset of construction tax by school districts. You have the fiscal and revenue statements on all of us. And the committee was wondering about the maximum indexed taxes. And the information is also up on all us. And in 2012-13 school year, the school districts were able to raise $15.5 million for capital projects. And before the first hearing, about 2 weeks ago, I checked with Legislative Council. This doesn't require 3/5. The law is permissive in nature, and with the repeal of the sunset, it remains permissive. So no fiscal, no revenue.
We're in a work session, Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 903 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 903 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. There are no amendments here. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 903 goes to the floor of the Oregon Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist, would you be so kind to carry this bill?
I would be delighted, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Closing the work session on 903. We have a couple of bills here relating to the senior property tax deferral. I know that Senator Shields has some of his staff here. Senator Farioli is coming down here as well. Are all three of these senior tax deferral bills, Dr. Warner? Or should we go to 728?
Yeah, so that's a different topic.
So,
Chris.
All right. Well, let's open up the hearing on our property tax deferral bills. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 813 and Senate Bill 924, and take a look at what some of these changes would do to the program. Yeah, why don't you?
Okay. All right. So once again, Mr. Chair, starting with, so yeah, we do have two bills up related to the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program. I'll go ahead and start with describing Senate Bill 813. And what the measure would do, it would require the lien amount placed upon property of tax-deferred homesteads to be equal to the actual amounts of deferred taxes, interest, and fees associated with the count. It would eliminate the requirement of the Department of Revenue to estimate future amounts of deferred taxes, interest, and fees and place a lien equal to the estimate. So that's what's being done at current law right now is the Department of Revenue, when the account begins, they'll estimate the amount they think would be deferred, and then that's the amount of the lien that's placed on the account. The bill would go on to modify existing liens on homestead properties, and it would allow a taxpayer to limit the amount of the lien for deferred taxes by making a payment. So if the lien is out there for maybe $20,000, they can make a payment of $5,000 to reduce that lien amount. And this would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015. In the background on the SMS and for both of these measures, I did include about the last 5 years and some of the legislative history because there has been a number of changes to the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program. So that is there for your reference.
Okay. And 924?
And Senate Bill 924, it requires the Department of Revenue to study the issue of allowing homesteads of senior citizens to enter the homestead property tax deferral program. And the homesteads that they'd be studying would be for seniors who have owned their homes for more than 10 years and where the homestead of the senior has increased, the real market value has increased by more than 50% over the immediately preceding 10 years. And the Department of Revenue is to submit the report of the study to the Interim Committees on Revenue of the Legislative Assembly no later than September 15th, 2015, and the bill declares an emergency and takes effect on passage.
Okay. Amanda, did you want to come up and testify in support of this bill? In fact, why don't we bring up John Mullen and Margaret O'Hartigan, who are all supported and testifying in favor of Senate Bill 924. And Amanda, we'll start with you.
Sure. Committee, Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amanda Hess, and I am the Chief of Staff for Oregon State Senator Chip Shields, who represents North and Northeast Portland, District 22. In the Oregon State Senate. He was taken away for child care duties this morning, but he asked that I read his statement into the record. Senator Shields writes, "Members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to consider Senate Bill 924 today. I drafted the bill on behalf of a constituent, Margaret O'Hartigan, who is here today to testify. Margaret will be more eloquent in explaining the bill, but SB 924 aims to stymie the gentrification or displacement of seniors who can no longer afford their property taxes due to a particularly sharp rise in property values in their neighborhoods. The bill allows the Department of Revenue to study the issue of allowing seniors whose homes have appreciated more than 50% over the last 10 years to enter the senior property tax deferral system. This issue is a particular concern to my district in Northeast Portland, and especially to the African American community, who has been pushed out of North and Northeast Portland over the last two decades, from 35% of the population to now only 15%. However, this issue is not limited to communities of color and is not limited to my district. I would like to thank Margaret for bringing this idea to my attention, for being here today, and for asking the legislature to study how this issue affects the entire state. I urge your support for Senate Bill 924 to better help our seniors stay in their community. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll go to Margaret.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for letting me speak. The State of Oregon Property Tax Deferral Program was an absolutely brilliant idea when it was conceived. It has functioned very well for many years. I live in a neighborhood that has probably seen the steepest rise in property values in much of Oregon, although I suspect it may be the case along the coast of Oregon and municipalities like Bend, and that's something I want to look into as well. The increase is absolutely stunning. In the wealthier neighborhood of Portland that I've looked at, property values have doubled, quadrupled, but most have only tripled in the past 20 years. In the King neighborhood, they have increased tenfold in that same time period. Now, part of the reason that has occurred is that the population of Oregon is increasing in general. Zoning laws, urban growth boundaries, and also the historic record in the city of Portland where certain neighborhoods were redlined and certain populations were restricted to dwelling. Banks would not give loans even for home repairs. And so there was a large housing stock that was depressed values. It's also where people of very limited means purchased housing. As recently as 1995, the neighborhoods I've studied, the King neighborhood, the properties were going for a third to a quarter what they were in immediately adjacent neighborhoods. And now what has happened, because redlining is no longer permitted, banks are making loans, the population is increasing, the property values have skyrocketed in King more than anywhere else. But I suspect this is true of any depressed housing market in the state that is now seeing growth. And so I've been watching as older residents move. They simply can't qualify at this point. The only sticking point, most of these people don't have $500,000 in assets in addition to their house. They don't have a beach house or a house in the mountains. The only thing keeping people from participating in this program is their house has skyrocketed from $30,000, $37,000 value 20 years ago to approaching $500,000. And it's the more I've looked into it, the more stunned I've been at this rapid change in this neighborhood. And I suspect it's the case also along the coast and in other areas. So I'm happy to answer questions if you have any about what I've been finding. And thank you so much for considering this.
All right. John, did you want to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I want to begin by saying that your staff has done a really good job with outlining the recent history of the property tax deferral program. I think it's really important to put that in the context of this particular bill. Members are aware, the property tax deferral program, the corpus, wound up being in jeopardy, actually had to have a loan to make sure that it was going to be solvent. And then the legislature took a number of steps to reduce the number of people that were eligible and cap a number of provisions within the program. Along the way, though, in subsequent sessions, it was really identified that we could make some improvements, allow people back into the programs. So I think that the history really just demonstrates that there have been opportunities to make some changes to this program to, again, do the best job that we can about helping seniors stay in their own homes. The issue that I think is worth studying about gentrification also just really goes back to one of the presenting problems when this discussion came up and the legislature took some drastic actions about the property tax deferral. That was in Clackamas County, for example, where I lived. There were a number of million-dollar homes that were part of the property tax deferral program. So I think the idea to study this program to make sure that we get it right for helping people in gentrifying areas that also don't have considerably more assets or income, in other words, where they don't need this kind of property tax relief. So I think it would make some sense to spend some time studying and looking at this and presenting some potential remedies back to the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. And Margaret, your problem is it runs into that median value requirement in Multnomah County. We'll check and see what it is.
Yes. When I first started looking into this, going to Multnomah County and finding out what the median value they were assigning and seeing how far below it is from the values placed on houses in the King neighborhood currently, and the state program, the median value for the house can increase 10% every biennium, which is less than a third of the rate that's currently occurring in King neighborhood. So the more time passes, the more housing stock will completely fall away from inclusion in this program. And even seniors that are currently retired or people in their 40s or 50s that are raising a family and looking to be able to stay in that house in 20 years are going to be facing an incredible tax burden and no way to qualify for the deferral program because of this increasing value.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, just looking at the most recent spreadsheet that's available on the Department of Revenue's website, there's definitely a lot of variability in this median RMV. I'm looking at Multnomah County, which is one of the higher ones, and the RMV limit is really, it's a function of the median RMV, but also the number of years a senior or a disabled individual has been in their home. So it would start off, if you've been in a home for 5 to 7 years, the median limit in Multnomah County, for example, would be about $262,000. However, if you've been in your home for over 25 years, that ranges up to $524,000 because it's based on a percentage of median RMV for the number of years you've been in your home. So the longer you've been in your home, the greater a property owner's property can be as compared to that median real market value for all residential improved properties in the county.
Okay. So it goes up to over $500,000. And you're saying, Margaret, that's still too low?
Actually, that's not the figures that are available on the website. Let me find that here. Okay.
You're on the DOR website, right?
Yeah.
He's probably on the
Multnomah County.
There we go. This is what I got off of online, and it shows for the 2014 county median RMV for the 2015 deferral for Multnomah County right now, it's $262,000 and $262,010, and then it shows after 5 years, it allows an additional 10% in value. So that would then at 7 years, it would allow a value of $288,211. After 25 years, it only allows a 200% increase in the value of the house, which is $524,000. But that's if you start now. I mean, that's if somebody purchased a house for $262,000 this year, which is actually almost impossible to find there. Most of the people that have been there long-term bought their house for $38,000, $35,000. One woman down the block bought her house for $7,000. And so as it increases, the allowed increase in RMV is far outstripped by what's actually occurring to the values of the houses. So like the woman who bought her house for $7,000, it's now worth, what was it? It's like this county says it's worth $381,000. So she doesn't qualify, even though she's been there a number of years to have an additional percentage permitted. It just doesn't begin. The difficulty is many of the value that's assigned, I've been in some of the houses that the county says is worth so much more. These are houses that haven't had a bathroom added. They haven't had a bedroom added. Nothing has been done to increase the value. They're being kept up. But it's not like somebody's put in a family room, built an addition, and the value should go up. This is just, in large part, so many people moving into the area and spending $500,000 to buy a house that 20 years ago could be purchased for $30,000.
Senator Boakley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to thank Senator Shields for bringing this forward, because this is the crux and this is the location of any potential property tax reform in the state of Oregon. This issue is the underlying issue in which any chance at either changing, improving, updating property tax issues in the state of Oregon are center mass here. In the work group last time, Mr. Chair, I pointed out the GIS system clearly points out that ground zero for every property tax initiative that's come out or referral is Multnomah County. And the crux and the problem of the volatility of the system makes your canyon thing with income tax look like
flatland.
Mm-hmm. And the problem here is that you have property value, property versus house value. The actual property real estate value is going up like this, which drives up these costs. And then the house value is actually, in real terms, decreasing. The anomaly of history in the last 20 years is the problem we face in Oregon, and that is we seem to have this thought process that all property and all houses are going to go up. The historical reality since recorded history back in around 1812, 1818 of property values in some cities around the state is that in every recession and after every war, property value actually goes down. And this notion that property is going to continue to rise defies all logic, especially in Oregon, because these are stick-built houses out of wood, and we have things called termite and rains and mildew and everything else. And the actual house structure's value really decreases over time. And until we identify, and I'm not sure this is exactly the way to do it, but until we can solve, frankly, in Oregon, the Multnomah County problem, that GIS map and the issue that they're talking about here, being able to pass a property tax reform in the state is going to be challenging, because these did not pass, frankly, as most people are misinformed. It wasn't rural Oregon that had this massive wave of property tax, cuts and all this. It's actually Multnomah County. And, of course, I would wager now, since we've been at this 20 years, it's unfortunately Washington County, too, because Washington County is now in this problem, that it doesn't get less rain in Beaverton than it does in Portland. It's just everybody's still in this thinking that, we have a $500,000 or $750,000 house out in Washington County, and it's going to continue to rise in value. And the fact of the matter is, the only thing that may or may not rise in value, and I can even question that, is the underlying real estate, because the house eventually is going to rot and fall apart, and it's going to go down. I would encourage more work in this particular area, because this is the crux of any future change. If you can't solve the Multnomah County problem, you're not going to get anybody to vote for property tax overhaul.
I am with you, sir. The way we solve this problem, not this problem, but the larger property tax issue, is with a statewide vote, however. And we need Multnomah County voters, since that's where the population is, to vote yes on these changes. We've talked about this in our tax reform work group on what it would take on a ballot measure to get voters to make that change that would address some of the ballot measures you're talking about, Measure 50 changes. Frankly, that's what made central assessment more difficult than it needed to be, was because of the ballot Measure 50 language that's there, that every corporation in America who wants to do business in Oregon is assessed property taxes has to be explained, okay, well, we had this thing called ballot Measure 50, and it's a little bit odd, but here's how it works. So, but we're digressing. Thank you for testifying on this. This bill is just a study, not a change, and so we'll look at perhaps moving this to Ways and Means or taking action on it next week. So thank you, Amanda. John?
Thank you.
Senator Ferrioli is here to come up with his testimony on 813. And we have a constituent of yours, Senator Ferrioli. Maybe. maybe you could set the stage.
Good morning, Mr. Puckett.
Good morning.
You're on with the committee.
I am.
Yes.
Mr. Puckett?
Yes.
Mark Hass from the Senate Revenue Committee. We have you here on the phone. First is your state senator, Ted Ferrioli, who's at the witness stand here. He'll kind of introduce you and your situation, and then we'd like to hear from you. Is that okay?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to discuss this issue. I'm Senator Ted Ferrioli from District 30. Mr. Puckett has an issue that I think touches on fairness and whether or not we're operating our state agencies for the convenience of bureaucrats or as a service to citizens. So I think this is a fascinating, interesting story of which approach we really are trying to take. Mr. Puckett is partaking in a deferral program that is available to seniors under the Homestead Exemption Program. Mr. Puckett's annual taxes are relatively low, less than a couple $1,000s a year. But as he's participated in the deferral program, the agency has placed a lien on his property, which is appropriate. But the amount of the lien is their entire calculated life expectancy of that deferral. So it's not just a couple $1,000s or even a couple $1,000s times a few years. It's the total amount of the tax bill plus the interest plus the costs plus the fees for the entire life expectancy and then a little, so that the agency feels that it's perfectly protected. So for a few $1,000s in deferral, the lien that was placed against the home is $37,000. So the issue for me is that when you look at a tax bill, roughly one-tenth of the total lien amount that's placed by the agency, what it actually does is creates a situation where the tax lien placed by our state agency actually is preventing Mr. Puckett from obtaining a home improvement loan, because the loan-to-value ratio then is skewed in favor of the tax lien, and the equity is tied up. That was never the intention of the program. The program was to provide an opportunity for seniors to defer their taxes, for the state to be able to secure its interest so that when the property is either transferred or the beneficiary passes away, those deferred taxes are caught up and paid, including all the accruals, the interest, et cetera. The solution to this problem, in my opinion, is to ask the agency to do a little more work in sharpening its pencil. Let the lien actually reflect the amount of dollars owed, and periodically update the lien, so that we're actually reflecting the state's interest, not an estimate of the future cost of the state's interest. So I'll let Mr. Puckett explain his exact situation, but to me this is a situation of equity and fairness. The solution is, I think the state could update its lien security virtually with a keystroke. You know, it's simply a matter of adding last year's taxes to this year's taxes, calculating the interest, and recording the lien. That is accomplished in the private sector through the Mortgage Electronic Recording Service, literally with a keystroke. So, Mr. Chairman, I invite you to talk to Mr. Puckett.
Mr. Puckett, where are you calling in from today?
Where am I calling from? Uh-huh. I'm calling from Prairie City, Oregon.
Prairie City. First time caller?
Yes.
Okay. All right, why don't you tell us your story? We also have the Department of Revenue on deck to talk about this as well. Go ahead.
Okay. What happened was that as a senior, I'm living on a fixed income. And I take advantage of any the weatherization program for seniors. every little bit helps my income, and it gives me a bit more freedom to live my life somewhat more comfortably. And it may only be a few $100s, but it all adds up. But what happened was, is after the winterization program, and I've invested in myself upwards of $25,000 in improvements in this home, and over the years, over where we're going on those 12 years. And it's a comfortable home. It's small. It's three bedroom. And it has a barn. And I try to put a little bit of money into it every year to keep it up now that I've done all the work. So when I called Community Connections, and they're really good people about helping seniors and other disabled people find shortcuts in order to increase their income somewhat. But I was told about the Oregon deferral program for seniors, tax deferral program for seniors. So I looked into it, and I found out that I qualified, so I went ahead and applied. And over the years now, 4 years, I've accumulated what is about $3,100 in taxes in the last four to five years. That I now owe the state. So I called Community Connections and I asked them what they could do to help me get another loan through Community Connections to do more improvements on the house. And when the fellow that I talked to, Cale Elder, he got back to me the same day, and he said, Donnie, because there isn't anything we can do for you because there's a lien on your property for $37,000 through the tax deferral program. And I said right then and there that I would have had to buy this property when I was 1 or 2 years old in order to accumulate that. So I called the Department of Revenue and I asked, what's this all about? And they told me that they use a program based on my life expectancy. And I said, but I've only been with the program for 4 years and I don't understand why I would accumulate $37,000. And I think the young lady tried to explain to me that if I was a professional, I would know, I would be able to get the proper information. That I was under the assumption I wasn't privy to the true amount. But as it turns out, every year I get a letter from the Department of Revenue showing how much I owe, including fees and including the 6% interest. So I went ahead and with my own bank, PNC Bank, and I applied for the refinancing to combine two mortgages and to maybe end up with a little extra money to do some things I need to finish updating the house. It took 5.5 months to get that loan to go through because they had so much trouble finding out just what the story was on that lien for $37,000. The underwriters evidently weren't asking the right questions. But eventually it was, the loan was okayed. I ended up with a few extra $1,000 in cash in order to finish the house. And I certainly do thank the state for having this program because it did put some approximately $500 to $600 a year more into my income, which pays for heating the home in the winter. But I think that it was an unnecessary burden on me and certainly a shock on me. And I'm certainly, I'm also aware of other seniors that have gone through this because this isn't the first time I've talked about it. And so it just seemed to me, and I really appreciate what my senator's done for me. But I think that it could be a little easier on what they actually owe.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing that story. We'll bring up the Department of Revenue, John Phillips. You want to weigh in on this? You want to stand by, Mr. Puckett?
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I should say bureaucrat with the Department of Revenue. Yes, the law, a statute that's not actually in the bill, requires the Department of Revenue to place an estimated lien on the properties for deferral. So that is the estimate that's being referred to in the bill, and the estimate that his Mr. Puckett's credit company was referring to when they were looking at his county records. The reason the department is really neutral in this bill. It's not something we necessarily insist upon or need or want or to secure our money. It's actually state money. It's general, you know, it's money that goes basically back into the program to provide additional deferral for people who apply in the future. So the fund is only viable if there's payments made out and then those payments are returned. So what we have in law is a provision for a lien. That lien protects the state's interests in being sure that the revolving fund is sustainable. We could certainly make the changes here. We could certainly refile liens with some level of frequency. For example, if we pay taxes this fall in November and file liens after that payment, that would be about $360,000 worth of lien fees we would pay and then charge to the seniors in the program. We just pass that on to them in the future. That would be that would come right out of the revolving fund balance, of course, because they're not required to pay us back yet. So we would have to look at that when we're considering, you know, sort of the sustainability of the fund. But that would be one thing we could do. We could certainly file them annually or more frequently because we do have interest accruing every month, but annually makes sense.
Would we need to change the law?
Yes. The one concern we have that you should be aware of is that if we don't have an estimate and if we file annually, then we're in a position of being supplanted in our lien position. So if we file our estimate and someone else then goes in and a senior tries to get like a refinance or an equity loan, that loan is then subordinate to our lien. If we do not file estimates and we just simply file liens every year, then any time a new lien is taken out on that property, then we would be subordinate for all future taxes and interest accrual to that lien. So just be aware that we would be in a subordinate position. And that is because the lien for deferral is not a tax lien. It's like a mortgage lien. It holds the same status as a mortgage lien. We have talked about in the past, and the House Committee has talked about in the past, in, you know, elevating the deferral lien to the status of a tax lien. And that basically would say no matter when it's filed, it would be superior to any liens, any other liens on the.
It surprises me that it's not like that.
Okay, too.
I think there was one particular lobby association that was against that, and I don't know if
Senator Boak was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me go to a hypothetical situation. I understand the problem. First issue I see is probably with several other members here is that we don't have a tax lien on the bloody thing, right? So it's first we're the ones doing it, so that's one solution. But another solution is let me understand the death portion of this. And that's what we're calculating here. So in theory, an individual signs up. Then under the law, there's a calculation, is my understanding, that says Mr. Smith is going to live 25 years. And then that's run against his property value, and that comes up with some level of this is what we think the taxes will be owned when he dies in so many years. Is that correct?
Something like that. I'm not intimately familiar with it. But.
So my question is, and we just made mention, is let's say Mr. Smith is going to live 20 years according to the actuaries and all this so and so forth, and it's $40,000 in taxes. Is there not, could the legislature, outside of a tax lien, not create something that's more economical or at least, for a better word, middle ground that says we think he's going to live 20 years and every 5 years we're going to update it? So if he makes it 5 years, the first 5 years we're going to put a lien for for $10,000, and then we're going to add another 10,000 five more years down the line, and another 10,000 5 years down the line, and then when we get to the end state, we have it. That, rather than doing an annual, which, as you point out, is $300,000 in tax liens, is there not some sort of, we could in fact do this on a rotating basis and only do portions of them maybe in five-year increments? So in the case of if Mr. Smith wanted to remodel in the first 10 years, which of course increases the value of the home, which is makes collection better for us, is that we just do a percentage of that. Is that not a feasible way to do this too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that's certainly an option. It's just a matter of your tolerance for how concerned you would be with being in second position for the later amounts, and if that's diminished, then that's a choice you'd have to make.
But just for the record, sure, I'm not worried about being in second place, because my thought is we're going to put ourselves in first place anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Senator Farioli, did you want to?
Well, Mr. Chairman, first I will not apologize for calling bureaucrats bureaucrats. There's no prejudice in that term. Maybe there was a note in my voice.
It's certainly not pejorative.
As my wife would say, you had a tone.
I had a tone.
Didn't take offense.
Not good. So, but I will tell you something. There's first of all, we calculate what's owed every year. And the guy, I mean, my constituent, Mr. Puckett, gets a letter that explains what the amount is. So it's not a mystery number. The relative position of our lien, I know most people assume it's first. Lenders consider it to be first. So if you have a tax lien on your property, that flags at the title company and everybody talks. That's why it takes 5 months to get the underwriters to agree that they can make a loan. But there is a simpler solution to this problem, and it doesn't even necessarily involve an annual update or a five-year update. What it does involve is this. We could, and it isn't on the agency. Let me make this clear. The deficiency is not within our stars, but within ourselves. The legislature created this program, and we can modify this program. But we could modify our security instrument to simply say that if the borrower or if the owner of the property attempts to put any other lien on the property, he must notify the Department of Revenue. The lender must notify the Department of Revenue. We can put ourselves in the first position and be secured. We can have a notification requirement to make sure that we are treated in the first position. And we don't necessarily have to do a rolling update, although that would be a possibility. It generates costs. But who pays the costs? The borrower pays the costs. So I guess, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can see no reason why we would have a situation where a person has a $500 to $600 annual tax bill that converts to a $37,000 lien. That just is illogical. It isn't serving the interests of the senior citizen, which is what this program was aimed at. And clearly, I believe that changes are warranted in this area. I had not contemplated changing the security instrument to make it a tax lien, although that seems like a very logical a solution, because it would automatically place the state in the first position. It just seems to me that if there is another lien in place from a bank and the tax lien was placed, there'd be a question of priority in that case. But I think the solution to this problem is simply to make sure that we are not overestimating the required accruals and using an actuarial approach to estimating the lien amount, rather than something that was more practical that serves the interests of the borrower and the senior citizen. So I commend this bill to your consideration. If this is not the right solution, I trust the chair of the committee and the members of the committee to find the right solution.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Phillips, last word.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, I have been on the phone with Mr. Puckett, and I have been on the phone with Community Connections, his lender, we work with lenders all the time, and this is the first time we've ever had one that has not, accepted the fact that the payoff amount.
Okay.
So, and I know when I have a mortgage, for example, or you have a mortgage, they file the loan amount, and everybody pretty much realizes that you're going to make monthly payments on that, and that loan amount will be coming down. So I think the lien for a mortgage company is going to be at a certain amount. But then when you refinance, they're going to call and say, what's the payoff? So it kind of works both ways in terms of the banking industry also and the mortgage industry. So, but we'd be happy to work with you on whatever direction you want to go.
Appreciate that. Okay, thank you, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Puckett, are you still there?
Yes.
We're gonna keep working on this. You're lucky to have a good ambassador for you over here at the state capitol and Senator Farioli. And
I know that. I'm very well aware of the competency of this man. He's a good man.
Well, thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. And it's interesting. It's striking to me that we're working on behalf of a man in the middle of this state in Prairie City, and Ms. O'Hartigan in Multnomah County, on the same day that we're working with Google, one of the largest conglomerates in the world. So we have kind of a gamut there, and a multi-talented committee that can make that leap. So thank you all. There's always tweaks to be made on the property tax deferral, and it is a very good program that helps a lot of people. So we'll close out our public hearings on our two property tax deferral bills, Senate Bill 813 and Senate Bill 924. Senator Boquist, 728 is your bill.
Right.
Is it not? You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 728. With a presentation by Chris first, and then Senator Boquist.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 728 pertains to what are referred to as the QPI, the Qualified Production Activities Income. Since 2004 at the federal level, there's been a deduction allowed for certain qualified income related to products that are produced here in the U.S. At the time in 2005, the legislature disconnected from that provision of federal law. So since that time, there has been an add back on the Oregon tax returns, both personal and corporate. It affects all business taxpayers, regardless of structure.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Brian Boquist, District 12. The bill that's for you, 728, before I jump to it, is actually designed to be a catalyst for discussion, frankly, amongst the committee members and amongst the various work groups working on tax reform. This is an issue that actually came up in the last session. What 728 really does in simple terms is it reconnects to the federal domestic production activities, the federal production activities deduction, which is intended to create manufacturing jobs in Oregon. Now, if it had not left Oregon and elsewhere over the 10 or 20 years due to the actions of both Democrats and Republicans in the federal Congress, we wouldn't need to do this. But we disconnected in 2004. The goal of 728, besides being part of the discussions of the overall tax issues, is to incentivize the manufacturing business and add back solid blue-collar jobs. Most of those, though, by the way, generally turn out to be union jobs, too, which I suppose is odd in theory for me sitting up here promoting union jobs, but I actually do. It's also designed, this sort of the domestic production activities deduction is also designed to complement other programs, especially programs like the CTE, in which we are working on now and elsewhere in this committee. LRO has done some job forecasts. Chris can address that. And the key point here is that what we're trying to do is add another tool in the toolbox to create living family wage living jobs. And it, like some of our other discussions, which we've had multiple times, frankly, in this committee, in multiple hearings, is, you know, an example of trying to do this is the theory that we might create our own expense and depreciation schedule that matches Oregon and tries to create jobs growth. And again, what this is intended to do is not a solution, but another one of those issues that we discuss. We discussed in the work groups previously in the last session. And it's one of those tools like creating expensing and depreciation at the state level that we need to consider. That, I'd be happy to answer questions. Chris is the real expert here on the federal code, but I'm delighted to answer any questions and delighted to work on anything else that I'm going to get voluntold for anyway.
Thank you. We don't have a revenue impact. Chris, have you looked into ramifications if we were to do this?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've started to take a look at the information, and I've looked at personal income tax returns and some corporate tax data, and it's a couple years old, so I'm still in the process of updating it, but getting a start on that. on the personal income tax returns, we see an add back of about $100 million. So those are taxpayers adding back the income. And so if I apply a 9% marginal rate, that's about a $9 million tax impact per year. On the corporate side, it's a little more difficult. So I reverted to federal information. And at the federal level, there are estimates that indicate the size of the impact or the size of the amount of the deduction is for corporations is double that on the personal side. So I have a $100 million deduction or add back for Oregon. And so I assume it's about a $200 million add back for corporations. So that's about $300 million in income that gets added back. And applying a kind of effective marginal tax rates to those, it's about a $9 million impact on the personal side and a $14 million impact on the corporate side. So based on that, Oregon right now with the addition is receiving $23 million of tax revenue between PIT and corporate due to the additions. And I did start to take a look at the jobs issue, and also at the federal level, there is some industry sector breakdown of where these deductions occur. So based on that assumption, just assuming kind of proportionally for Oregon that the deduction occurs in the same sectors as at the national level, I've taken a stab at conducting an in-plan analysis and assuming that the tax savings gets reinvested, because that's a big question for what happens. So the tax gets, if this policy were to become in place, there's a tax reduction for these taxpayers of $23 million a year. The question is, what do they do with that money? So in terms of a kind of a standard process for understanding a potential jobs impact, we assume that it's invested, and that's how I use in-plan. And I've started there with some of the big sectors first, and not surprisingly, the semiconductor sector, the high-tech sector is the biggest one. And so I started with the top 10 sectors, and of that $23 million, about $10 million gets applied to these 10 sectors. And from that, for every million, I think the easiest way to think about it is that every $1 million invested results in about 5.5 or 6 jobs in terms of a potential jobs impact. So I took that $10 million impact, ran it through in-plan, and got a 56 job impact per year, and that includes the direct, the indirect, and the induced effects. And the direct effects are specifically tied to that investment. The indirect effects are increased demand for basically the supply chain related to that investment, and the induced effects are the job impact from the greater economic activity. And so it's all very preliminary work that I've done, but that's what I've done to date.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Riley.
So did I hear you right that this assumes that the entire amount is reinvested and not paid out to shareholders? Is that what I hear?
Correct. That's the starting assumption, the reinvestment.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And again, for the record here, what we're trying to do is get ourselves all educated on the various tools in the toolbox, because across the board, if we are successful, and some of us, I guess, are hopeful we're successful, we're talking about some flattening and changes in the tax code, possible depreciation schedules at Oregon only. And Mr. Chair, and to Senator Riley specific, and yes, what we need to do is figure out mechanisms to ensure it is reinvested. But that's the key point. I have been an advocate behind the scenes in the various work groups of the differential between active and passive. I'm not a fan of passive. I am a fan of active involvement in the Oregon economy. And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for the consideration of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. We have no one else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 728. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 728, and we have cleared out our agenda. No other business is before us, so we are adjourned.